From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Sarah Baldwin. In the middle of the Jordanian desert sit thousands of rocks carved with inscriptions in an ancient form of Arabic. Their meaning has long been a mystery. But one night in 2013, Ahmad Al-Jalad, an expert in the early history of Arabic, managed to decipher a few key words in the inscriptions. By morning, he'd made a major breakthrough.
He had basically assembled this entire zodiac, this entire way of referring to different constellations that was a zodiac that we didn't know existed. It was an Arabian zodiac.
That's Elias Muhanna, a professor of comparative literature in the Watson Institute's Middle East Studies program. He wrote about Al-Jalad for The New Yorker in May 2018. Al-Jalad's work has been part of a recent explosion in our understanding of pre-Islamic language and culture in the Arabian Peninsula. I spoke with Muhanna about Al-Jalad's groundbreaking research and how it's helped recast common narratives of early Arabic history. I started by asking him how they first met.
So Ahmed and I met actually in graduate school, but he was really a kind of a prodigy. He had this incredible talent for languages, he was self-taught in many ways.
And not just any language, right?
Exactly. He had taught himself classical Arabic and Hebrew and a lot of ancient languages and had sort of discovered his passion for ancient history and language while he was in college. And I had been kind of interested in him and his research and his ideas just when we were graduate school buddies. And I kind of followed his career after he finished and went on to be a professor of Semitic linguistics at Leiden University in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm. And so what is his work about? Talk about these alphabets and these ancient languages and why they're important, especially in the context of the history of Arabic and the history of Islam.
Right. So his work is really exciting because it deals with this enormous trove of inscriptions that are written on rocks in the middle of the desert. In the Jordanian desert, there's a part of the desert that is completely black, basically. It's a basalt desert, the result of like these volcanic eruptions hundreds and hundreds of thousands of millions of years ago, actually.
The Hara.
Yeah. And it covers, there's several of these volcanic deserts in northern Saudi Arabia and eastern Jordan. And at some point, you know, people, Bedouins, you know, goat herds, began writing inscriptions on these rocks. This is like 2,000 years ago. So it's before the revelation of Islam, before the region becomes Islamized. And for hundreds of years, nobody could read these things. They didn't know what they were. And to this day, actually, people who live in Jordan, many people who live in that area, assume that these inscriptions are written in Turkish or written in some other language because they're written using glyphs, like an alphabet that look like runes. So people didn't really know what these texts were. And at some point in the 19th century, they were deciphered. Orientalists, took a crack at it and basically began to decipher the texts and realized that they were some kind of a form of Arabic, but they weren't written in the Arabic script because the Arabic script hadn't been invented yet. I mean, that would come like hundreds of years later.
And can you describe what is the technical term for that kind of writing?
Well, so the name of the alphabet is called Safaitic, and it's, you know, because it was first discovered in the vicinity of a place called Safa, Tlul Safa in southern Syria. And I think the term that you're referring to is Boustrophedon. So that's just really, that means a style of writing where the words kind of wrap back and forth. It's not like left to right or right to left.
Like an ox turning.
Yeah, like an ox turning.
Greek, yeah. I thought that was so interesting.
So the script is deciphered, but for a long time the study of these inscriptions kind of languishes because very few people work on them, and they've deciphered the script, but they don't really know, they still can't really make sense of the language and the culture that produced these inscriptions. So Ahmed comes along and He's taught by the world's foremost scholar who works on these inscriptions, Michael McDonald. I mean, Michael basically took him under his wing and in a very much like an oral tradition, taught him how to work with these kinds of texts. And it's funny because Michael himself had been taught by a former, you know, a previous scholar who was kind of an independent scholar. And the kind of chain of transmission had passed that way all the way back into the 19th century.
Wow. It's almost like an apprenticeship.
Exactly. It was very much like that. Yeah. What's interesting about this kind of scholarship is that it's very slow and it's very laborious, and you have to spend a lot of time with texts that you don't really understand, and you have to kind of keep them all in your head just in case there's a moment when something is going to kind of click. And I think, you know, Ahmed described that experience of working at home in Leiden, you know, and just going over these inscriptions. And something clicked for him one night when he was reading some inscriptions that contained words that had previously been translated as proper nouns, you know, as place names. And that's kind of a cheat. You know, when you don't know what something means, often you say, well, maybe it was the name of a place. You know, there were a bunch of these inscriptions that had these words that had words in them that they really had no explanation for what the words were. And he noticed that they all talked about, they all had a mention of traveling in search of, in search of rain. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of hit him that maybe they weren't place names on the ground, but they referred to constellations, because certain constellations would be seen in the sky at different times of the year. And so maybe they were somehow references to the seasons, which could be a reference to seasonal migration in search of rain across the desert, going to different places.
So navigating by the stars in a way.
Navigating by the stars and going... going places, time telling, calendrical, you know, telling, so that we travel to such and such a place when Aries was, you know, in this part of the sky or whatever. And he started to collect every one of these inscriptions that he had kind of flagged as containing words that he didn't really know. And lo and behold, like many of them were related to this theme of migration. And so he worked all night long. And by the end of the night, he had basically assembled this entire zodiac, this entire way of referring to different constellations that was a zodiac that we didn't know existed. It was an Arabian zodiac. And so that kind of work, I think, is really exciting, and we don't do a whole lot of it. You know, we don't associate that kind of scientific / humanistic way of approaching history so much anymore. And so I found it really exciting and wanted to know more about it.
Mm-hmm. He's so young and he sounds so old in his in his story, right?
Yes, yeah, he's quite a fascinating individual. There's one of the things that Ahmed often talks about is the difficulty of knowing what Arabia was like around the time that Muhammad lived, right? So, you know, around in the early 7th century. And so what kinds of sources do we turn to explain, to really kind of tell that history? And invariably, we turn to chronicles that were written by historians, Muslim historians, living usually a couple centuries after the death of Muhammad. So historians are really bound by, like contemporary historians are constrained by the evidence that we have. We have a huge amount of so-called literary evidence. So we have a lot of chronicles and we have a wealth of information. And that has traditionally been the source for how we try to reconstruct early Islamic history. But because the Arabian Peninsula, basically Saudi Arabia, for most of, let's say, the 19th and 20th century, has been kind of off limits to other kinds of inquiry, other kinds of exploration, like archaeology, basically, there hasn't been a whole lot of documentary evidence. The kinds of things that historians would ideally like to have in addition to literary sources. So in those places up in the north, in Syria, in Iraq and in Jordan and in Lebanon and stuff, there's been a ton, and, you know, Palestine, Israel, there's been a ton of archaeological excavation. In fact, like archaeology there in Egypt, is that's kind of where the field of archaeology really prospered, grew. But in you know, Mecca, Medina, certainly, like, there have not been a lot of excavations for understandable reasons. That has begun to change, but really in the past 10 years or so, there's been really a boom of archaeological excavation in across the Arabian Peninsula, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Yemen, Oman, a lot of places. And
what are they trying to prove?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, the archaeologists I spoke to, many of them felt that there was an interest on the part of ministries of culture and, you know, museums in exploring their country's, like, pre-Islamic heritage, you know, as a way of, I mean, when you look to the northern Arab countries, again, Syria, Lebanon, and Egypt, actually, also, they've always kind of they've celebrated their let's say Muslim heritage as well as a pre-Islamic heritage. So the Egyptians can point to the pyramids and say, "Well, we were civilized long before the arrival of Islam," and the Lebanese can point to Baalbek, you know, the Roman ruins, and say, like, you know, we were Roman or we were Phoenician at one point. And the Syrians, the same thing; they can point to Palmyra. The Jordanians point to Petra, you know, all these civilizations that existed before the Islamic invasions. And for the longest time, you know, the countries of the Arabian Gulf, Persian Gulf, really kind of started their histories with Islam. You know, it was kind of like that was the beginning of civilization. And we've seen a real shift in recent years where there's been a real interest in exploring what came before. And I think for a long time, there was an assumption that nothing came before, or that there had been a Bedouin culture there. And so there was a culture of some kind, but it wasn't a so-called civilized culture. It wasn't a sedentary culture. It didn't produce monuments, so there was no way to recapture that. And I think that there's been a realization that that's just not true, that there were, in fact, fascinating, very advanced civilizations across the peninsula. We'd always known that there had been those kinds of civilizations in places like Yemen, where they had left monumental inscriptions and large buildings, and so there was real evidence of advanced civilizations there. But in Saudi Arabia, there was kind of an assumption that it was just desert until Islam came, basically. If you ask 100 people about this, that you might get 100 different answers. But I think that it's safe to say that there is a kind of mystique associated for many Muslims with the idea of something being born in the desert, you know, where it couldn't have been influenced by some other outside thing, that accrues to its miraculous nature, that the Quran, you know, was revealed to somebody who many believe was illiterate, you know, the prophet. So he didn't write it himself. It had to be a miracle that it came to him. And what's really interesting is to see how I think this kind of evidence really raises questions about what we can learn about the culture, the first audience of the Quran, the first audience, the first Muslims. The more we learn about that culture, the more we can really begin to understand actually the ways in which it was, you know, the way in which these texts actually did emerge out of something. That's what makes this research really exciting, but also potentially sensitive, you know.
Has he gotten pushback to your knowledge?
He has not. I mean, I follow his, he's very active now on social media, and if anything, you know, his work has been really kind of gobbled up by people in the region, you know. And that's one of the things that I think he's found really exciting is that he is constantly receiving photographs from amateur archaeologists in Saudi Arabia and in Jordan. Like, I there was this inscription, you know, near my house, and I took a picture of it, and what do you think of this? And so, and it's not just Ahmed, Leila Naami, the linguist in Paris that I spoke to, said, it's just amazing. I get emails all the time from people across the region saying, like, I took a photograph of this inscription and here it is. Here are the here's the coordinates. And so we're really living at a moment where all this inscriptional evidence is kind of like coming to the fore now.
It's so cool. It's like it was always out there. We just needed someone to read it.
We needed someone to read it, and we needed a way to circulate it easily. So I think it's a story of technology.
Well, that's what interests me in your essay as well. It's so quintessentially you, right? It's ancient and literary and digital.
Right. So you know, the proliferation of camera phones, social media, people being able to share all this stuff, and the speed of it is, you know, it took like 100 years for the script to be deciphered, and it circulated exclusively in like scholarly journals, and, you know, things people would argue over what a word meant for like 30 years, basically, because that was the pace at which it happened. But now, I mean, Ahmed posts a picture of an unpublished inscription that someone has sent him that he's studied. He posts on Twitter. And you would not believe the people that who come out of the woodwork and say it must mean this or it must mean that.
Like amateur philologists?
Amateur philologists.
I knew there was such a thing.
Yeah, it turns out there's a lot of really big epigraphy buffs and people who, I mean, not all the inscriptions are written in languages that only he can read, uh-huh. or in scripts that only he can read. Some of them are, you know, in early Arabic, mm-hmm. and it's really interesting.
Well, so tell me about going to the desert with him in 2017. What was that trip like? I mean, it sounds like you're walking, like it's a library on the ground, and you're just walking, and all the books are open.
Yeah.
Is that overstating?
No, it's kind of like that. I flew out to Amman, and I didn't really know what to expect. You know, he and I are really good friends, and so I was looking forward to hanging out with him, but I had no sense of what it was going to be like. So we got in a car with him and Ali Al-Manasir, who is a professor, a researcher, who was then based at Oxford, Jordanian, and we all kind of jumped in a car and like drove east. On the road that runs from Amman to Baghdad. So it's like this two-lane road. And we just kept driving out into the desert. And this is, at this point, like, there was a lot of activity. We were like 30 or 40 miles, maybe 20 or 30 miles at one point, from the Syrian border. And this is when ISIS was really active in Syria still. It hadn't been defeated. And they were all clustered just north of the border, and there were airstrikes. I mean, there were fighter jets flying over us the entire weekend to, you know, sorties into Syria from Jordan. A lot of military activity happening at the time, and there were smugglers, and, you know, the town we were in was really kind of like a one-horse town that was very much a smuggler's town. There was like cars racing through with like tinted windows, and we stayed on like a military base, a Jordanian military base, where that had like a sort of a ramshackle research institute that had seen better days in the 90s. It was all very kind of Spartan, but it was great. I mean, we'd get up early in the morning and go out into the desert. We had a Bedouin guide, and we would just kind of like pull off the highway and drive for about an hour into the desert.
Did you have GPS coordinates that you were trying to find?
So yeah, we did. And Ali, the other researcher on the team, kind of knew this area like the back of his hand. And we would walk around, and to me it was just undifferentiated basalt, you know, rocks everywhere. But he really knew where we were, and he would like look at different hills, and he'd know where people had been before, where previous excavations had gone. And he knew what, you know, which hills had been published in which journals, which findings, and so on. So he had a very clear sense of where he wanted to go. And so we got out there, and then we would just kind of walk. And we'd usually walk towards hills, because that's where a lot of the inscriptions were clustered.
Why?
So you have to imagine these huge tribes would arrive, you know, would come north, and they would bring all their animals with them. And this area is completely, it's a big desert now, but you have to imagine like 2000 years ago, it was a kind of a savanna. So although there were, you know, all these basalt rocks, it was actually, it was really pasture land. And over time, it becomes, there's a process of desertification that really transforms these landscapes. So they would bring all their animals and they would let them basically pasture there. And the shepherds would want to be up on higher ground so they could keep an eye on predators and also any, you know, anybody who was coming to raid or anything like that. And that's where they would spend their time. And so that's where we'd find all these like graffiti basically on these rocks.
So it was like graffiti. What were they using?
They're using flint. So flint is very hard and very sharp. And they would use that to etch these messages on the rocks. And, you know, the word graffiti, Ahmed doesn't like to use it so much. For the longest time, that's how they were described. That's how they were, you know, written about in the sources. He doesn't like to use that term because graffiti we think of as an informal practice. And so you just see random letters on walls, and that's graffiti. And for him, Ahmed really thinks of it as a kind of a formalized, a kind of form of monumentality, that there's a real grammar to these things and they fall in patterns and it's a memorializing activity.
Yeah, I got that sense from your article that it that it has a memorializing function, that it has a musing or even an artistic poetic function. But also, I thought it was so interesting, this idea of monumentality being in our minds like a Greco-Roman concept of largeness and impressiveness, and yet something small and etched can also have a monumental function.
For sure. That's, you know, very much something that he stresses, that we come out into the field with, you know, with our own ideas about what monumentality looks like, what memorials are supposed to look like, and we have to kind of we have to adjust our preconceptions. So they have cameras, and they, you know, every time they see an inscription, they take a picture of it, and it goes into the database. And it has its coordinates and everything. So GIS technology has evolved, you know, tremendously just in the past 15 years. And so now a lot of these inscriptions that are in the database have all this additional information. So it enables you to do lots of things. It enables you to track the movements of the tribes, because a lot of the inscriptions have the names of the people who wrote them. In fact, sometimes that's all they have, like so-and-so was here, you know? And when they say so-and-so was here, it's not like, you know,
Kilroy.
It's like Kilroy, son of, and then grandson of, and it goes for generations and generations. If you can imagine having a database, and there's 50,000 of these things. So if you can track these names and maybe track the families, you can basically begin to have a picture of where they moved and why.
In your lifetime?
Oh yeah, for sure. I think so. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of, you know, putting it all in one place. But it is right now in one digital database, but I think there's more that can be done with it. Mm-hmm. There's different kinds of search functionality.
Does his work affect your scholarship? I mean, you're comparative literature, but you're also a historian. Mm-hmm. You study knowledge.
Yeah, you know, I've always been interested in language, and especially the history of the Arabic language, and that was one of the things that drew me to Ahmed's work when we were in graduate school. And so it does intersect strongly with my own work, not so much my most recent publications, but my next project, which is about, which deals with the history of the Arabic language and the vernacular, and, you know, the differences between spoken language and written language, and how those two things kind of interacted with each other throughout the history of the Middle East. So, it does intersect strongly with one of my big research interests.
Do you think you might collaborate ever, the two of you?
Well, we're trying to, we're working together a little bit on this big corpus, which is called Oceana, the online corpus of inscriptions from ancient North Arabia. And it's based at Oxford, and we're trying to work together on bringing Brown's. So Brown is a leader in the field of digital epigraphy. We're kind of like one of the most... one of the best places to be for that kind of thing. And we have a couple major projects on ancient inscriptions, digital corpora of ancient inscriptions, based here at Brown, and so we have a lot of expertise on how to deal with this kind of, how to build these corpora and bring them up to date. So we're hoping to maybe collaborate a little bit on just kind of like turning the functionality of that corpus, kind of raising it a little bit, because the technology has changed so much in recent years.
Elias, thank you so much for coming and talking to us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I hope you'll come back. This episode of Trending Globally was produced by Babette Thomas, John Mazza, Dan Richards, and Alex LaFerriere. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. I'm your host, Sarah Baldwin. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. It really helps others find the show. For information about this and other shows, go to brown.watson.edu. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for another episode of Trending Globally.